makes you happy, ladies and gentlemen? I can tell you for me, so for me, for example, standing on top of the mountain. Because you see, I grew up in the mountains, and just seeing the mountains gives me a sense of really belonging to this world. But for most of you living on an island, it might be very different. For you, it, for example, might be standing at the beach, at the ocean, and hearing the waves roll in and feeling the water on your skin, which might really give you a sense of infinity. But in fact, we should not confound what makes us happy to the state of happiness itself. Because we all might quite differ in what triggers this state, in what triggers our emotions. This depends on our culture we were brought up on, our personal history, our characters. But how we feel happiness is the same for all of us, and this is what I would like to talk about. How can we know that we all feel happiness in a very similar way? Let's look at this young man. He's from people of Korea, living on the islands of Papua New Guinea. And when his photo was shot by the American psychologist Paul Ekman in the late 1960s, his people, and in particular this man, never had any contact with any other culture, any other people from the outside world. And yet, you immediately understand how this man must be feeling. He's smiling, he's happy. And he will understand your smiles and your happiness. Paul Ekman, when doing this research, was a true pioneer. Because up to that time, it was widely believed that we learn how we sense and how we express our emotions. Now, Ekman showed that this could not be true. Because if we learn how we sense and express our emotions, it would be very likely that this man from a culture who had never contact with the world outside would express his emotion in a very different way from us Western people, for example. Just as he speaks a very different language from ours. But in fact, he doesn't. And this has been corroborated by many other findings later on with many other people. And this is the reason why we can conduct scientific research on happiness and on other emotional causes, while at all, they are human universals. So, this kind of research led Paul Ekman to identify two basic emotions, namely fear and sadness and happiness, that are present more or less with people throughout the world. Now, what is an emotion at all? In the understanding of modern neuropsychology, emotions are signals for situations to seek or to avoid. Fear, for example, makes you avoid a situation that is potentially dangerous. And with happiness, nature seduces us into a behavior she wants from us. To give you simple examples, we need food for survival, so we enjoy a good meal. Nature wants us to procreate, while for sex is fun. And no one can live on his or her own. No one can live on his or her own, which is where we have warm feelings towards the people near to us. Now, I find it very important to realize that happiness is not some kind of lofty intellectual construct. Is a very important capability. It is a very earthy capability fitting into all our brains. And it's very important to understand how it works. For trying to build sophisticated philosophies on happiness, without understanding the very fundamentals of it, To me, sometimes seems like trying to conduct an orchestra without knowing even how a violin makes its sound. Now, of course, we have come a long way from the late 60s, and still have science. Science today cannot only look onto the faces of people while generating emotion, it can look right into their heads, like into the brain. And when these photos were first published about 7 years ago, they were almost as sensational as the one of Paul Ekman with the people of Papua New Guinea. What you see here are sad and happy brains, and the colors correspond roughly to the amount of energy, that is, to the activity in various parts of the brains. Now, this was done by telling people to think of their saddest and their happiest situations in their lives, which for most of them the saddest situation, of course, was losing a dear one, and the happiest situation for most of the problems was to think of falling in love, to think of the day of their marriage, or just meeting again a beloved person they had lost track of. And why they were thinking of those situations, that people were placed in a brain scanner, pretty similar to the ones you might know from the hospital, and hence measuring the activities in the brain while people are perceiving these feelings. Now, why are those pictures so important? I think they are so I think they illustrate two very crucial things. First, you can measure emotions at all. And second, there is a specific pattern in the brain with each emotion. Now, you sometimes read in the popular press there is the one center in the brain for happiness or lust. And this picture shows you that this can't be true. Rather, happiness is generated in a specific way of many centers in the brain acting together. So really almost the whole brain, or at least many parts of the brain, are involved when you're feeling happy. And to show you that such research can indeed answer questions on which the jury has long been out, just think of the long-standing debate in philosophy whether happiness is just the absence of pain, or maybe more after all. And this discussion, is happiness more than just the opposite of unhappiness, of course, translates in our everyday thinking. How often do we hope to be happy if we just could get rid of some unpleasant situation? Just think of all the lonely hearts who think life will be heavens after they finally found him or her. And then he or she really appears, and after a period of falling in love, I don't know. And this graph gives you one thing why it is so. Look at it. If happiness would really be just the opposite of unhappiness, the pictures, which again are based on the previous ones and show activities in the brain, you would expect them to look down like positive or negative of one another. But they really do not. They are just different. And many other findings from neuroscience show that happiness is really more than the absence of happiness. It is something different. It is something of its own. Of which the consequence, of course, is that to attain happiness, don't just wait for the pain to end, but rather you have to do something for it. Now, how is happiness being generated within our heads? In our heads, as you just saw, there are really networks for joy, lust, and euphoria. And we are equipped really with something that I once called a happiness system. And this is quite a new finding, and I am sure that this finding will affect our image of man in the 21st century at least as much as Freud's idea on the ever trouble-making unconsciousness were crucial for our image of man in the 20th century. We are born to be happy. And I would like to talk you through a brief walk through this happiness system, of which you can distinguish at least three subsystems, namely one for enjoyment, liking something, one for lust and learning, wanting something, and one to control our emotions. Now, the first two of these functions, liking and wanting, are emotionally very old. You would even find them analogously in many animals. And there is a third one, emotional control, is genuinely human. Now, you might, of course, wonder now why does he distinguish between liking and wanting? If I like something, I want it, and if I want it, I like it only. Well, yes, normally you do, but not always. Just think, for example, of an addicted smoker who ran out of his or her cigarettes. Now, it's raining outside, and he wants nothing so much as a new pack of cigarettes. So he gets it. But this being the 26th cigarette of the day, will he really enjoy it? I seriously doubt it. And you can show, and I'll show you in a moment, that wanting and liking are indeed are governed by different mechanisms in the brain. So let's start with enjoyment, liking. Crucial to or a central role within this system played a class of molecules which are called opioids, of which I have shown you one here, this is beta-endorphin. This is famous with joggers for bringing about the runner's high, but this is far from its everyday function. Now, opioids are chemically identical to the agents of opium, hence their name. But they're generated within our heads, so everybody of us really has a kind of drug labs in our brains. Now, what would happen if we wouldn't have that system? If we couldn't generate opioids, or if they wouldn't work. You can cry out. You can knock out their function by taking certain pharmaceuticals, and the situation is, and the consequences are so nasty that the man who first did those experiments, a German called Heinz Fahnerich, did not want to impose them upon any other subject. He tried it onto himself, he knocked out the workings of the systems of enjoyment, and he convincingly told me that this was absolutely horrible, so horrible that he would right have jumped out of the window if only if he would have felt the energy, the motivation for it, but it was in complete apathy. So, opioids or any neurochemicals, of course, are not happiness, but without them, you cannot feel happiness. You just cannot, and you would not even be able to survive. You wouldn't get out of the bag in the morning. So if a person tells me now, I can't be happy at all, there is nothing bright and I in my life, I don't believe it, I don't buy it, even if this is a clinically depressed person, because the answer to it is, now look, if there was really no motivation within you at all, you just wouldn't be there. You wouldn't have got up this morning. What do we need the system for? Well, they really reward us, and they are a lure for us to go for any reward. And this is what symbolizes the movie poster I brought you here, for really any reward, be it a spectacle with flowers, be it love, be it sex, be it food, be it entertainment whatsoever. And they also have an important function in our human relationship. They provide us with a sense of warmth when being together with people we really like, and Tanya Singer might or might not later give impact to this. So the bottom line of this is that the ability to feel happy is by no means a luxury of nature, it is indeed a prerequisite for all of our survival. Lust, wanting something, works in a quite different manner. A central role in this system plays that molecule, it's called dopamine. And dopamine really does many things within our brains. First of all, it directs our attention to a promising aim, as you see here, for example. It creates a feeling of lust and euphoria. And most importantly, if the promising situation meets our expectation, or even is better than expectation, than our expectation, it gives feedback. And then it enables our brains to learn, because we shall learn the situation in order to seek it again or to repeat it. So, dopamine is also present in this situation. This works with any kind of learning. And the dopamine cells of this guy, a chimp looking for termites and learning how to get them out of the earth with a stick, now they really go bang, bang, bang. Lust, curiosity, and learning are really intrinsically intertwined. And without lust, there can be no learning at all. Well, there only can be some kind of fear conditioning, but this is not what you usually think of when you talk of intellectual learning. The Americans have coined a nice saying out of this finding: the brain runs on fun. And I think that this truth is still by far not sufficiently being recognized by the way we run our schools, our universities, it's not recognized by the way our companies operate, and even not by the way we do social work. And this is why I would like to go very briefly a little deeper into it. Now, what does learning mean? Learning, and any learning, essentially corresponds to the creation of new connections in your brain between the neurons which you see here. And dopamine, the so-called lust hormone, promotes precisely that. And this is why creativity and also analytical capacities is linked to positive and not to negative emotions. So the myth of unhappiness as a prerequisite for artistic achievements is just that. It's a myth. And there's no time now to elaborate on this, but I'd be very happy to go deeper into this maybe in the discussion. Third, emotion control. Now this is a very human way of dealing with our emotions. We are not mere subjects of our emotions, as Mathieu vividly pointed out. How does emotion control work? Now, experiments with babies have shown that already from very early on in our lives, the processing of lust on the one hand and of disgust in the other hand is linked to a hemispheric asymmetry. The left hemisphere of the prefrontal cortex, namely here, is more active when we are dealing with positive emotions. The right hemisphere is more active when dealing with negative emotions. And this has been shown with babies. How do you create positive and negative emotions in them? I tell you what happens to those ones in the experiment. The one has got some drops of sugar water, and on the tongue of the other, some drops of squeezed lemon have been dropped, of which he didn't like it. So, this asymmetry first has been shown with EEG data, that is from electrical currents in the brain. But it later really has been pinned down up to single neuron in the prefrontal cortex. It also has been shown that well adjusted persons show more left prefrontal cortex activity than mentally more unstable persons. And it has been shown that what the left prefrontal hemisphere in this function does, it does many things. But in this context, what it does, it actually works like a very quick off switch for negative emotions like anger and sadness or fear generated by other parts of the brain. So, if all of this is true, and if you see these asymmetries, if you see these asymmetries already with babies, one might suspect that we are born with a sunny state of mind, or not. And for a while, it indeed looked so. Mainly that, as our moderator has suspected, that the capability to be well adjusted is genetical and is inborn. But then the researchers who conducted those experiments retested the babies whose hemispheric asymmetries have been monitored 10, 20 years earlier. And what I found is that both the affective side, that is being well adjusted on now, and hence the hemispheric asymmetry are plastic. They can change within our lives. And how and to what extent such changes can happen was certainly one of the biggest surprises in neuroscience in the last years, which brings me to my last point. This was, I don't think it's exaggerated to say that it was a revolution in neuroscience that researchers realized how malleable our brains are, and they really realized it only in the last 15 years. Or in 10 years. Up to then, it was thought our brains are once we have reached adulthood. And we now know that this is simply not true. The brain is highly malleable. New connections are being built, but also others disappear all the time. Even in old brains, new neurons are being produced and reproduced, a thing that has been thought completely impossible, say, little more than 10 years ago. It is now even possible to watch such changes in real time and look how fast they go. This is the dendrites, the kind of the branches of a neuron on the right. We now know that emotions, in particular those which we perceive consciously, promote such changes, and one consequence of this is that emotions that we perceive consciously are hence reinforced. Of which the consequence is that we indeed can, to a certain extent of course, tune our brains into positive emotions. Now, some of the people with the most extravagant hemispheric asymmetry, namely geared towards the left, if you wish, happy hemisphere of the prefrontal cortex, were indeed Tibetan monks who had 10,000 of hours of meditation behind them, and I know Mathieu was a part of this research. So, should we all go through 10,000 hours of meditation? Well, I think it is a good idea for some, but maybe not for all of them, and it really need not be. I think it is, first of all, it is important to realize that it is really possible to train our capabilities for happiness, just as we can train to speak a foreign language or to train to ride the bus. It doesn't come from today to tomorrow. It needs a training. And this is really where today's neuroscience meets with insights of certain Buddhist schools, but also of insight gained by the antique schools of philosophy of the store, for example. They were very aware of it, and this knowledge later has been lost, the importance of training. So, what can you do? Now, here are some advices of neuroscience. The first and I think most crucial point are cognitive strategies, that is, controlling your negative emotions. Mind you, I do not speak of suppressing negative emotions. I think negative emotions are important. They are signals. Signals want to tell us something, but once you have received the signal, fine, there you are. You know what's going on. You don't need to go into your anger or your sadness or your fear anymore. And such cognitive strategies have been shown to be by far the most effective psychological strategy to deal with even severe depression. You can go beyond that. You can reinforce your positive emotions by simply keeping track of them. And one strategy that has proven to be very efficient is just to write them down. This is my last slide. Second, be active. Nature rewards us with happiness for activeness, not for just lazing out in the sun. Third, physical exercise and sex. Happiness is a very bodily feeling, and studies in social psychology shows that the content of people with life is very strongly correlated with the amount of physical exercise that pursue, and of course the amount of sex and its quality, if you wish, like that. Sharpen your perception. I talked about how the dopamine system directed our attention is related to euphoria, learning, but also attention. Be curious and see contrasts in life for the very same reason. And to, I think, no one's surprise, interpersonal relationships are very important. I would like to conclude with two philosophers. The first one from a Stoic school named Epicurus, of whom Alan talked this morning. We should bestow great care on happiness because we have everything when it's present and do everything to achieve it when it lacks. And about Spinoza, the Dutch philosopher of the Enlightenment, already was quite aware how much happiness is linked to our cognitive and creative performance, saying joy is a transition of mind into a state of perfection. Thank you very much.